We'll hear arguments first this morning in Witters against the Washington Department for Services for the Blind. Mr. Ferris, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. This morning the Court has before it a Religion Clause case involving a vocational rehabilitation program for the blind. It's important to note that it is a neutral program and that it is broadly available to all blind citizens of the State of Washington. This is not an occasion where the State of Washington's legislature has attempted to subterfuge the decisions of this Court and go around and find a clever way to get state aid to religious schools. Nor is this a case where it can be claimed that this is not really aid to individuals, but is a transparent fiction of aid to religious schools.
Mr. Farris, before you proceed, has Mr. Witter completed his training for the ministry?
No, Your Honor. He was required to drop out because of lack of financial ability.
I see.
And well, was he an undergraduate or a graduate student?
He was in Bible school, which was leading to a BA degree, which was an undergraduate program, which would qualify him by itself, though, for certain ministerial positions.
I take it if he were eligible, he'd pursue his education for the ministry under this State of Washington program?
That is correct, Your Honor. It is his desire to return to the program and to finish his education.
Is he pursuing some other educational degree at the moment?
No, Your Honor. He is washing dishes in a medical laboratory.
Thank you.
It is our position in this case that there is no justification under the Establishment Clause to single out ministerial students for exclusion from the participation in a broad government program. We would also argue that the Free Exercise Clause indeed forbids such exclusion. The guiding principle that this Court has used in its Religion Clause cases is the principle of religious neutrality. And we think that the government does not have to discriminate against religious persons in order to prove how neutral it is. Ministerial students do not have to be quarantined from the access to public benefits in order to demonstrate that the Church is committed to a course of religious neutrality, or the State is committed to a course of religious neutrality. On the first half of our argument, we will deal with the Establishment Clause, and we must deal both with the position of the State Supreme Court and the State Department for the Blind, because the State Department, although they support the result below, they have switched positions and now have abandoned the reasoning below and are making a new line of argument. First, we will deal with the State Supreme Court. That court held that, flatly, the government may never fund the training of ministers. Now, the problem with this is, of course, that it endangers not only this federal program, but the GI Bill, Social Security recipients who use their benefits to train for the ministry, and programs like the Federally Insured Student Loan Program.
Would you explain that? How does that get in the picture?
If a person's father, for example, passes away while they're going to college, they would be eligible for certain dependents' benefits under the Social Security program, which they could use for various forms of training, including ministerial training, among others.
Well, they could use it to start a filling station, too, if they wanted, couldn't they? There's no limit on what they could do.
Well, the benefits that I was referring to were the educational benefits that you're entitled to as a student under certain Social Security programs. The position of the State Supreme Court, we contend, is not in accordance with this Court's rulings. This Court has never struck down a neutral program that is broadly available to all citizens, and this Court has indeed said that such a program is not readily subject to an Establishment Clause challenge. Now, the State Supreme Court held that the primary effect of the aid to Witters was to advance religion. Now, the error in this analysis is that they looked solely at Witters rather than looking at the primary effect of the entire program. And it's our contention that the proper judge of the primary effect prong of the Court's tripartite test under Lemon versus Kurtzman, they should have looked at the entire program, not just simply the aid to Witters.
Mr. Ferris, do you concede that the State of Washington could, if it chose, have a vocational rehabilitation program which expressly excludes any educational funding for the ministry?
We would concede, Your Honor, that this would be a much more difficult case here. We would think
that. Well, do you think it would be valid under the Establishment Clause for the state to have such an express provision?
It would be valid under the Establishment Clause. The problem would be with the Free Exercise Clause.
Would it be valid under the Free Exercise Clause?
I don't believe that it would under this Court's holdings in Sherbert and Thomas. I think that such an express exclusion for religious persons only would run counter to that. But that is a more difficult case.
So it's your position that if the state wants to fund educational aid for students, it must include educational aid for religious students study?
I think that there's a difference between educational aid, perhaps, and vocational rehabilitation, which is career training. This is job placement kind of aid. And under the state of Washington's law, this comes under the public assistance code, not the education code. And this Court's ruling
should
in
it matter what code the legislature enacts it under for a constitutional inquiry?
It shouldn't, but this Court's decision seemed to have treated the various sections differently. Sherbert and Thomas stand as examples of public assistance benefits which have overturned exclusions based on religion.
It just seems to me that your argument would lead inevitably to conclude that a state could not withhold funding for religious education at any level and in any program.
I don't think that we are required to go that far, Your Honor. That perhaps is our position, but it's this Court's position, as it said many times, to draw lines. And we think that there is no occasion to say that the line should be drawn on the other side of this case to exclude Mr. Witters from participation. We would, in the
Has this Court ever funded religious education before?
No, this Court does not appropriate funds. That's the job of the legislature.
Well, I don't mean that, of course, obviously. Has it ever approved the funding of religious education in any decided case heretofore?
Yes, Your Honor, it has. In the case of Everson versus the Board, this Court held that the education in that case was pervasively religious, and it was the central mission of the Catholic Church in that case in particular to religiously educate their children. That is religious education. And this Court permitted an indirect benefit to that education in the form of transportation benefits and many other cases. The aid to religion cases that this Court has held have oftentimes involved institutions that admittedly were giving religious education, and various forms of indirect state aid to those religious institutions has been permitted by this Court in a number of instances.
Mr. Ferris, does Mr. Witters urge that his religious beliefs and practices require him to study theology?
Your Honor, his position is that he feels a religious call to the ministry, much as Reverend McDaniel did in the case of McDaniel versus Patty. And that is a personal religious call. It's not something that the belief system per se requires, but more as a private direction from between him and God as he perceives it.
After the various wars we've been in, are there any limitations placed by Congress on what studies the veterans could pursue?
No, all parties in this case, including Respondent and the Solicitor General's Office, concede that the GI Bill has been used for decades to be allowed persons to be trained for the ministry, including a number of seminaries and rabbinical schools that are eligible currently for the use of such GI benefits. And it's our argument today that this case is constitutionally indistinguishable from such a program. Now, the state, the Department for the Blind's position, their new position that they've switched from, is based, first of all, upon arguments that are outside the record and facts that are outside the record. They, among other things, are attacking for the first time in this Court the constitutionality of an entire federal program, although that issue was never raised in any court below. And neither was the fact that gives some potential relevancy to this federal program introduced below, and that is that this is the federal program in question. There's no factual proof of that, and counsel for the petitioner has no knowledge of whether that is true or not. In any event, these new arguments and these new facts are very easily answered. The federal statutes and regulations in question require the state, according to their argument, to evaluate, to counsel, and to approve the program of the blind individual who comes into participation in the vocational rehabilitation scheme. Now, this can be done, we would contend, objectively. In fact, the statutes and the regulations in contest require objectivity. 29 U.S.C. Section 722b4 that's in the appendix of the respondent's brief requires objective criteria and an evaluation procedure. and 34 Code of Federal Regulations, 361.33B, lists those objective criteria, such as educational achievement and work experience. There is nothing in this record before this Court that gives rise to any basis for speculating as to the way the actual program works under the federal guidelines, that there's some violation under the imprimatur test or the excessive entanglement test. There it would be simply speculating on the part of the respondent that would even get us into these questions, and there is nothing in the record to support such speculation. As we have argued in our reply brief, we think this is a perfect analogy to this situation is a building inspector who is required to approve a church's building plans. Now, that building inspector must evaluate the plans, sometimes must counsel the church's architect or church's builder or carpenters on the appropriateness of their plan, the placement of the pews, the placement of the baptistry, the location of the altar, perhaps for safety reasons. And they must ultimately approve those church building plans. We contend that that's the same kind of situation that is at hand today. Both situations are hands-on in the analogy or the criteria that is advanced by the state in this case. They've said hands-on funding of ministerial programs are unconstitutional, while hands-off programs like the GI Bill are appropriately constitutional. These may provide neat labels, but there is no constitutional justification for these labels. Our position is that all citizens in all buildings must be treated equally. Church buildings are treated just like any other assembly building. Blind ministerial students must be treated equally just like all other blind students. The respondents, however, does not distance itself from the central fallacy of the state Supreme Court, although they try to basically repudiate that court's decision. That is, they still continue to focus on just ministerial students to make their analysis of the primary effect test and the excessive entanglement test. In this court, in the case of Mueller and in Widmar, held that the provisions of benefits to a broad spectrum of groups is an important index of secular effect. And the state chooses to ignore the fact that this has been the case here, that there is a broad spectrum of groups of all blind students of all careers that are entitled to participate in the program. That we would suggest that there is no imprimatur of government approval or of religious institutions in this circumstance. That this equal treatment has never been held by this court to be an unconstitutional, to create an unconstitutional imprimatur under the terms of Widmar versus Venson and a number of other cases. There is no fatal symbolism in this case, as would be suggested by the state. In fact, we would say that the public would perceive this more as an anti-discrimination kind of law rather than an endorsement of religion kind of law that this court has found to be fatally violating the First Amendment. In the case of McDaniel versus Patty, this court rejected an idea that's central to the state's position, and that is that ministers as symbols of the church somehow justify disparate treatment of those ministers. Now, of course, we're dealing here with ministerial students rather than those who have accomplished their training and have reached their desired career objective. There's no constitutional distinguishment between those two statuses. Simply because Larry Witters wants to be a minister, the state feels that there's some symbolic violation of the First Amendment here.
You would say make the same argument if he were studying, Hinduism or Islam or Confucianism?
It would not make any difference
to
for our theory.
To be a clergyman in those respective faiths.
Yes, the leaders of those faiths would be equally entitled to participate. Or the leaders of secular faiths that this court have recognized in certain of their of its cases. We would contend that there is no excessive entanglement here, that in the counseling program that the state has suggested must take place. The requirements are...
Mr. Parris, I gather the Supreme Court didn't reach the entanglement question, did it?
No, it found the entanglement analysis ill-suited to this case, and it found a lack of facts in the record to do that. And we think that the Supreme Court of the state of Washington was right on those points, saying that the state did not build this record to bring an entanglement argument.
If we thought that issue was still open, what should we do, send it back?
Well, it would only be open, Your Honor, if the state's allowed to proceed into its new arguments, and I think that the face of the record is pretty certain. At the worst case, it should be sent back rather than holding that the excessive entanglement doctrine has been violated here. Tommy?
But the state is entitled to present that position, I suppose, as it was presented to the Washington Supreme Court. and it just wasn't ruled on.
They did not argue, Your Honor, at the Washington State Supreme Court level or at any level below that the program violated the First Amendment. It was their contention always before that the First Amendment was irrelevant. And so it would seem
that nevertheless, the Washington Supreme Court thought there was an entanglement issue, but it just put it aside. And I suppose the state may argue for affirmance based on that ground. It may be an infirm argument, but they're entitled to argue it.
Well, they're entitled to argue it, certainly.
Is it also possible that the Supreme Court or the state thought there was so little to the argument that it didn't deserve any comment at all?
Well, I think that would be more in line with our position, Your Honor. But in any event, the state Supreme Court said that the rather than there was an entanglement issue, they thought that the analysis was ill-suited to the case and there was no record. And I think that they basically just said the primary effect test was the one that was pertinent.
Mr. Ferris, is that a fair statement what they did? They said that because they relied on the effect, the second prong, they didn't have to reach the third. That's all they said. They didn't have to reach the entanglement issue.
They did use the phrase, Your Honor, that the
it's unnecessary for us to attempt, well, I guess they say a strained analysis of the entanglement
right.
factor, but they'd already decided the case.
That's correct. And they would have been appropriate to, even if they thought there was an establishment clause or an entanglement problem, to not decide the issue. But I don't read their opinion as suggesting that they really thought that there was one there.
I guess Justice Utter's dissent rejected the entanglement argument, didn't he?
Yes, Justice Utter made a very thorough analysis, and we are in strong support of his position in this case and rely on it greatly. Thomas Jefferson once wrote, and this Court has quoted it before, that the clergy here in this country seem to have relinquished all pretensions to privilege and to stand on a footing with lawyers, physicians, etc. They ought, therefore, to possess the same rights. That is the central theme of our Establishment Clause argument, that ministers ought to possess the same rights in the Department for the Blind as in every other department that is appropriately involved with ministers in the state of Washington. Under the free exercise portion of our argument, before we get into the merits of that, we must address the issue of whether this Court should decide the issue now or remand it for a decision of the state constitutional issue. Some of the amici, most particularly the Solicitor General's office, has raised the suggestion that this case be remanded for a decision of the state constitutional issue, since it would be, in all fairness, to say that the Supreme Court of Washington hinted at their result but ducked the issue.
You mean remanded after this Court disposes of the issues that the Supreme Court of Washington did decide?
That's correct, Your Honor. And they, although the Solicitor's Office does not cite the case, some of the other amici cite the case of Rescue Army against Municipal Court. We rely on Widmar versus Vincent to counter this argument. In the Rescue Army case, there was a complex statutory scheme that was not fully interpreted by the California courts. And this Court held that remand is appropriate under circumstances where state law is highly ambiguous or if a state law construction is fairly possible to avoid the federal constitutional issues. This Court also said in the Rescue Army case that discretion would be exercised depending upon the degree of uncertainty about the state law issue. In this case, there is no ambiguity. There is no uncertainty in this case. If there is a discretionary spectrum involved, this case is as far at the end of uncertainty side as can possibly be. And it's our contention, as we argued in our reply brief, that there is no difference between this case and Widmar as far as this issue is concerned.
So you don't think that even if furnishing this aid would not be an establishment, you think that the state of Washington would have to extend it, that it couldn't just say, well, whether this is an establishment or not, we prefer not to furnish aid to this kind of religious education?
That would be our position, Your Honor, but that is not this case. This case is that the legislature of the state of Washington chose to fund this kind of aid. And it's our position that this Court ought to permit, both under the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause, the enforcement of that legislative will.
Well, I suppose the commission thought that extending the aid would violate the state constitution, didn't it?
That's correct.
What are you going to do about that?
Well, it's our position that the state constitutional provision, as so applied, is unconstitutional as applied, just like the
so
state.
So you have to get to your free exercise argument, don't you?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And you have to win on it, really, in the long run to do any good.
That's absolutely correct, yeah. Your Honor. Well,
and in fact, if it is correct that the state constitution prohibits this kind of state aid, then we do have the case that I posed to you and Justice White posed to you in the question. We would have a situation where the state says you can't provide this kind of aid in a vocational rehabilitation or any other kind of a program.
It would be analogous to Sherbert and Thomas in that kind of situation, yes, Your Honor.
But we don't have that case at the present time, do we?
It's my position that you do not, because there's been a distinction between applying a constitutional provision. I think there is a distinction between applying the state constitutional provision and the policymakers of the state saying, we want to fund this aid. Now, the state... Yeah.
There is no question that the state of Washington legislature passed a statute which is construed by the Supreme Court of Washington, said we want to fund this aid. The Supreme Court of Washington then says, no, you can't because of the First Amendment of the United States Constitution. Now, if this court were to hold that was wrong, then down the road there might be the case where the Supreme Court of Washington would say, well, it violates the state constitution. But it hasn't said that as at this stage of the litigation.
It has not directly said that. It's hinted at
it wrongly. Is that the whole picture? Are there not state administrative regulations in this very program that make it clear that aid will not be furnished, payments won't be made to pay for religious study?
There is a policy that has been advanced, but it does not rise to the form of a regulation. It's simply a letter ruling, in effect, and it does not ride to the — it's not in the state administrative code, and so that there is a state informal policy. And there is an adjudication.
Adjudication that is reviewable, I suppose.
That's correct, and it was reviewable to the state Supreme Court, and they chose not to review it.
That's the way an awful lot of law is made, by adjudication.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Mr. Ferris, may I just review one thing with you? Is it not correct that if we should agree with you on the Establishment Clause issue as a federal constitutional matter, and if we should be in doubt as to what the state might do with its own constitution on that, that then we could remand without ever reaching the free exercise issue?
That's correct, Your Honor, but we would contend that there is no doubt.
At least two members of the state Supreme Court thought it did not violate the state's constitution. Is that not correct?
That's correct.
And they actually addressed the issue.
That's correct. Yeah. But we think that the language adopted by the seven-member majority was so clear as to their intent of what they would do if they had to reach the issue. They said, in effect, our state constitution requires a far stricter separation of church and state, which I have described in our reply brief as an anvil-like hint of what they were going to do if they actually reached the state constitutional issue.
There's a lot of difference between anvil-like hints when you misinterpret the federal constitution and actually deciding it.
That is
I'm not
correct.
Suggesting they did misinterpret, but it's a little different as a matter of fact.
That is correct, Your Honor. But under the Rescue Army criteria of is there ambiguity, is there uncertainty, we would suggest there is no uncertainty in the state Supreme Court's position on this.
Well, there certainly is no ambiguity or uncertainty about the state's policy as interpreted by the state's highest court. And the state's policy is not to fund this kind of education.
That is the state Supreme Court's
So we don't have to be concerned about what the state constitution says, because as a matter of state policy, as interpreted by the state court, they don't fund it.
I think that
And you take the position that the free exercise clause of the federal constitution requires them to fund it against their will.
Well, I would not characterize it as state policy, Your Honor. State policy, in my view, is made by the legislature. The policy is not made by the courts. Courts are there to interpret the law, not to make policy. And so that, in my theory of the case, there is a difference between policy and constitutional adjudication.
Well, let's explore this a little bit further. I realize you probably have other things you want to get onto. But is there a state policy which says this kind of education will not be funded, even though the legislature has said it should be, unless there's some constitutional difficulty with the funding?
I don't know of any such policy, Your Honor. In fact, we cite in our opening brief another program of higher education that was granting aid to all private schools in the state of Washington, private college students. And in there was an exclusion for those pursuing a theological course of study. And it's our argument that if the state legislature wants to exclude these kind of people, it knows how to do it, and it has done so in the past. And the argument about state policy, I think, is made difficult because the state constitutional provisions have been interpreted to prohibit aid of any kind to religious colleges at all.
What precisely is the source of this state policy to which you referred in answering Justice O'Connor's question?
My understanding of what constitutes state policy for constitutional purposes.
I mean, in this particular case, the question is there is a state policy against this. Now, what is this? How does that policy manifest itself? Who said so?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think there is a broad thing that we can call state policy. We have state statutes and we have the state constitution and we have court interpretations. I think that the policy analysis ascribes to — must be pinned upon some legal document, some legal process, and I don't see one.
Well, we're not talking about some administrator then who intransigently refuses to carry out the will of the legislature, even though there are no constitutional impediments to his doing so.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Supreme Court of Washington purported to be expressing was a federal constitutional policy.
And that is also correct, Your Honor. We think that they were obviously in error. Briefly, and the free exercise arguments raised by the respondent, they argued that this is a case like Harris versus McRae, and this court should not fund against the legislative will. As we've argued already, we are not asking this court to override the legislative will. In fact, both Congress and the state of Washington's legislature, who are the source of the funds in this case, have said it is okay for ministerial students to participate. We think this case is indistinguishable from McDaniel, Thomas, Sherbert, and the other cases of this court, and would ask this court to affirm, or to reverse, rather, the decision of the court below.
Mr. Malone.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. I wish to address 4 points. First, I wish to discuss why this particular vocational rehabilitation program is not like the GI Bill, or, and this is saying the same thing, why it's not like the program involved in Mueller versus Allen. And I wish to discuss why this difference is critical constitutionally. Second, I wish to touch on this question that has been referred to in counsel's argument as to the statutory source of the federal funding and the supposed deficiencies of the record on this question, because that bears upon whether or not I should have been making my first point at all. Thirdly, I wish to examine how this question of our submission differs from that of the court below and what difference, if any, it makes. And fourthly, I wish to step back and ask, what role does the Free Exercise Clause play in all of this? And I think by now it's apparent that it's important indeed, and that the petitioner is trying to use the Free Exercise Clause not only to invalidate the religion clauses of our state constitution, but also to have the Free Exercise Clause swallow up a large part, I would suggest, of the Establishment Clause jurisprudence of this court as well. Before turning to our first point, though, I want to take up this question of state policy. We have two constitutional provisions that are relevant in this case.
In which constitution?
The state constitution. Article 1, Section 11 says, "No public money shall be applied to any religious instruction." Article 9, Section 4 says, "All schools maintained or supported, wholly or in part, by public funds, shall be ever free from sectarian control." In Weiss versus Bruno, a decision of our state Supreme Court, which was referred to in the decision below in this very case, the court made it clear that it takes a under those religion clauses, the funding restrictions for religious instruction for church-affiliated schools are even more strict than those established by this court under the Establishment Clause. Now, that's the source of the policy that we are talking about. That
policy, state constitutional
policy. The state constitution. Now, that policy in the state constitution was embodied in a written policy statement applicable to this particular program, which said we cannot fund ministerial students. But Justice Rehnquist, absolutely right, that policy is embodied right in the Constitution. Secondly, I would suggest that there is nothing in the state statutes involving this program which are contrary to that policy. The state statutes, or the state statute which we used to have, it was changed somewhat in 1983, said the Commission for the Blind may maintain or cause to be maintained a program of services to assist visually handicapped people. Under such program, the Commission may provide for special education or training in professions, businesses, etc. New statute for all practical purposes is quite similar in this respect, that is discretionary. I do not read in there a legislative determination that, boy, we want to fund ministerial training. So again, we have the basic policy established in our Constitution, which the petitioner wishes to have invalidated, and we do not have a clear legislative declaration that it wants to override that policy.
General Malone, that certainly isn't the position taken by the Supreme Court of Washington. I realize that you differ from the Supreme Court of Washington, but certainly the easy way out for the Supreme Court of Washington in this case would be to say, well, this statute doesn't authorize what the plaintiff wants, so we don't have to get to any constitution.
I'm not saying the statute doesn't authorize it. I'm saying the statute does not, that the statute is ambiguous and the statute shows the legislature did not specifically address the question, do we fund ministerial training or don't we?
Well, but the Supreme Court of Washington certainly took the position that ministerial training was going to be funded unless there was a constitutional objection to it, don't you think?
Let me put it this way. They certainly took the position that it was okay for the Department of Services for the Blind to put blind people through the program, including the program of ministerial training, unless there was a constitutional objection to it. Yes. With that,
function to try to construe the state constitution here when the Supreme Court did not rely on it?
All I'm trying to, Mr. Justice Berger, absolutely not. What I am trying to point out is what the source of this state policy is and how it goes right back to our Constitution. And even more importantly,
well, Mr. Malone, under your version of the applicable Washington law, would it be perfectly all right to have funded Mr. Witter's education at Inland School if he wanted to study history, for example?
If he wanted to study solely history, yes.
He could do that in a religious school?
Yes. Indeed.
And it would be all right under the state constitution and as well as the federal to pay the tuition?
Not certainly the federal. Probably the state, at least if he wants to be an historian, wants that to be his profession. I would like to discuss then why this vocational rehabilitation program is simply not like the GI Bill and why that difference is constitutionally critical. Now, what I might call the normal rule seems to be that in cases such as this, one must separate out the secular from the sectarian and fund only the secular, not the sectarian. However, there is apparently an exception. If what you might call the delivery system embodies a hands-off, passive role on the part of the government, and if the program, in terms of beneficiaries, is sufficiently broad-based, apparently one does not need to make this separation. I would suggest that is the rationale which was applied in Mueller. I would suggest that that is the rationale which would justify the application of the GI Bill to ministerial training. Now, there is, of course, in this case, no effort whatsoever to make any such separation. So the effort must be to come within what we might call the Mueller GI Bill exception. And the Solicitor General and the petitioner in his opening brief argued exactly that. This program was just like the GI Bill, and the Mueller rationale applied. Now, we say that it's not like the GI Bill. The Mueller rationale does not apply. And let me illustrate in terms of the GI Bill itself. Under the GI Bill, The government really just cares that the veteran is in an accredited school and that's it. The specific school that he goes to, as long as it's accredited, and by the way, the federal government doesn't even do the accreditation. Specific school is of no concern to the government. What courses he takes are of no concern to the government. Whether the student has made any sort of career choice is of no concern to the government. He could take Sanskrit and spend the rest of his time wandering around in India, say, and that's of no concern to the government at all. But let's change things. Let's suppose that the government amended the GI Bill and said, you have to make a career choice now, and we have to approve that career choice. In light of that career choice, we also have to approve the school and the courses you want to select to make sure that it all fits. Now, let's set aside for a moment the question of how the government goes about making those decisions, what criteria it uses to approve or not to approve those choices. The mere fact of need for approval, it seems to me, changes the delivery system, if you will, and takes the program out of the Mueller rationale, the Mueller GI Bill exception, and back into the normal rule of leading, of having to come bring about that submission. And I suggest that the vocational rehabilitation program we have here is exactly like that new GI Bill, and therefore it cannot fall within the Mueller rationale, the Mueller exception, and the normal rule that you have to make the separation
of powers. Are you asking that we focus on the fact that in order to get the aid, Mr. Witters must subject himself to state regulation? Is that your concern? Or is it that it advances religion, in your view, because Mr. Witters wants to become a minister? Which
both.
Is it?
I focus on both, so to speak, what is delivered, what the state is buying, Justice O'Connor.
But do you think the court normally looks at the program as a whole rather than focusing on the individual receiving the aid in these cases?
It is precisely, yes, it is precisely there that we part company somewhat with our court, with the court below.
Well, do you think this court generally has given a broader focus to the inquiry rather than just looking to the individual? For example, suppose the state has a welfare program and hands out welfare money to someone who tells you, I'm going to give part of this money to the church.
Absolutely.
On Sunday. Is that okay?
Absolutely, of course. Yes, absolutely no problem there. But what's the difference from that situation and the situation here? The situation you have here is, I suggest this. Mr. Witters wants the state to buy for him ministerial training. Now, that's not a good start under the Free Exercise Clause. And indeed, our state Supreme Court would say that fact in and of itself is fatal. We suggest, though it's not a good start, it's not the end of the inquiry, precisely, Justice O'Connor, because of the point that you just raised. You have to look not only at what is provided, at what is delivered, you have to look at the nature of the delivery system, at the breadth of the types of beneficiaries, the overall scope of the program, and also, in looking at the overall program, you also have to look at the role of the state in that program in order to see whether or not it embodies a hands-off policy, such as I suggest you had in Mueller, or whether it and such as I suggest you also have in the GI Bill. And our basic submission is that if you do not have that hands-off policy, then you're back under the normal rule. You have to separate out the religious and the secular.
General Malone, was this Inland Empire Bible School, was that an undergraduate institution?
I believe that it was.
And if Mr. Witters had qualified under the GI Bill, could he have taken just the courses and enrolled for just what he proposed to enroll under the GI Bill?
I believe he could have, as I understand the GI Bill. And again, the reason that we say he can't use our money for that or he can't use this program for that is because of the differences in the delivery system between the GI Bill and this program. Now, the petitioner says that this question of state involvement under this program is being exaggerated, and that we can make approval decisions on the basis of objective criteria, and that somehow this solves the problem. Well, I suggest that it does not solve the problem at all. The state has to approve, first of all, the career choice. I think we're all agreed on that. Let's see how objective criteria might work in that respect. Suppose, again, on the basis of objective criteria, say Department of Labor data, the Episcopal Church we find has a surplus of priests and the Catholic Church has a shortage. Or there's a great need for Lutheran ministers, but there doesn't seem to be much need at all for denominational ministers. Now, the vocational educational counselor then, right at the start, is going to have to say, I'm sorry, I can't help you if you want to be Episcopalian, if you want to be an Episcopal priest or a non-denominational minister. But if you want to be a Lutheran minister or a Catholic priest, yes, on the basis of these objective criteria, I can help you. Suppose one particular seminary or Bible college has a great success rate in its placement of its graduates. And suppose another one has a low success rate. So the voc rehab counselor has to say to the student, though you really want to go to seminary X, I'm sorry, if you want to be a minister or a priest, you have to go to seminary Y. Suppose we had something like an objective test, say put out by Educational Testing Service up in Princeton, similar to the LSAT, for ministerial students. Counselor or some state official at least is going to have to decide on a cutoff point as to, you know, sort of who passes and who flunks. And he's going to have to say to one student, okay, we'll pay for your ministerial training, and he's going to have to say to another, we won't pay for yours. The test indicates to us you're too low, you're not going to be a success either in school, or you're not going to be a success in the ministry. Now, I think that, I dare say, the likelihood of these things happening, even under the so-called objective criteria, which the petitioner would have you rely on, it seems to me, the likelihood of these things happening should be very disturbing, whether we focus on either the second or the third prong of the Lemon test.
General Malone, what is there in the record to tell us anything about the likelihood that any of these things might happen?
In terms of the actual operation, well, let me put it another way. We do know that this is 80% federally funded. The record does not say where that federal funding comes from. The Solicitor General at page, I forget which page, but in footnote 11 says, we think it's the 1973 Rehabilitation Act.
Did you at the trial level in this case have an adequate opportunity to present evidence of this kind of problem that might develop in this case?
Yes and no, and let me explain that answer. Through the trial court level, and indeed, through the state supreme, through the argument before the state supreme court, the only thing we were talking about were the state constitutional provisions that I mentioned at the beginning of my argument. So there was no need to focus at all upon the Establishment Clause problem at all, or the entanglement problem in particular.
Yeah, but whether you elected to rely on the federal constitution in defending your opponent's claim was certainly within your control, not within your adversary's.
Certainly. For this issue, Justice.
Let me ask one other question. Supposing, as has been suggested, that we thought there was no merit to the establishment, to the primary effects defense, but maybe there's a problem with the entanglement, as you argue today.
Yes.
And they haven't decided it, and say we sent it back and decide the entanglement issue. Couldn't you then develop the record that would support this argument?
Certainly.
Could do it much
certainly,
better?
Mr. Justice Stevens. On the one hand, I realize the difficulties which come from just relying upon the federal regulations, the federal statutes, the federal regulations. I understand those difficulties. And we believe those could be taken care of.
Your hypotheticals have triggered a question in my mind I'd like to put to you, if I may. You talked about employment opportunities in different denominations. Supposing you had an unemployed assistant pastor of the Lutheran Church or something. He went in for unemployment compensation. Would he be denied unemployment compensation?
No. And let me put to you another
Wouldn't he
case.
Have to prove that he'd really been a minister and he was eligible and all that sort of stuff?
One, would he have to be denied unemployment compensation under the Establishment Clause? No. Would he be under the religion provisions of our state constitution? I would suggest no. Which raises another question. Let's suppose, Justice Stevens, let's suppose that he's a minister and he happens to be going blind, and so he needs to learn Braille. And now I'm getting to touching upon the free exercise issue. And suppose he comes to the Department of Services for the Blind and says, I'm not going to be able to perform my functions as a minister unless I get this training in Braille. Will you give it to me? And my answer would be the free exercise clause would require that we give it to him. The establishment clause would not prohibit it, nor would the religion clauses of our state constitution. Why? Because Braille is not religion specific. That is to say, Braille is something which somebody could well want for purposes having nothing to do with religion. Now, what I'm suggesting, and this gets back to Justice O'Connor's question as to the scope of the free exercise clause here, it seems to me that under such cases as McDaniel v. Patey and Sherbert versus Verner, what was involved there were benefits or rights or whatever that were not religion-specific. What Mr. Witters wants here is to use the free exercise clause to require the state to give him something that is religion-specific. McDaniel v. Patey does not
require
that.
Well, it all depends on the lens with which you view it. If you look at the whole program and say what we have here is educational funding, for vocational rehabilitation, then it isn't religious specific. If you focus just on Mr. Witters, it is. The same in Sherbert, the same in Thomas. It depends on how you look at it.
I am using the religion specific, not religion specific distinction, Justice O'Connor, as a distinction which should be embodied in applying the free exercise clause. When you get to the Establishment Clause question, I suggest that indeed the question is how do you look to it, and I suggest that the critical question is under what circumstances do you have to make this separation, which clearly is not being made here. And I'm suggesting that this case does not present the circumstances under which you have the GI Bill or the Mueller-type exception. I would suggest then that these objective criteria are going to produce very strange results, which I should suggest this Court should find very disturbing under the Establishment Clause. Now, this counselor that I was talking about quite possibly might find some way out of this, might say, well, I'm getting over my head.
General Malone, I noticed there were hearings first before an initial hearing officer and then a review within the administrative agency. Was any evidence as to how the program works or whether there would be counselors involved brought out there?
None of what I am discussing now was brought out at those administrative proceedings. Because, again, Justice Rehnquist, what we were focusing on was, at that stage, all the way up until the Supreme Court of the State of Washington issued an opinion, all we were focusing on were the state religion clauses. For my discussion here as to entanglement, I am relying upon the federal regulations and the state regulations, which pretty much track them.
Say about a foundation that was created to grant scholarships, only one purpose, to grant scholarships to students studying for the priesthood of the Roman Catholic Church. Would it be entitled to 501c3 if that's the right section, exemption from
Yes,
taxes?
And I believe that it would, and I believe that it would under the reasoning of this court in Walz. The answer would be yes.
It wouldn't make any difference. It would be obvious then that if it were for all religions, it would be equally good.
Yes. I see no problem with 501c3. But again, 501c3 involves a hands-off delivery system, as did the tax deduction. I'm sorry.
You think that's like the tax case in the New York situation?
No, the tax case in Mueller. I'm referring to Mueller when I say that 501c3
well,
is like
it not
Mueller.
Also comparable to the general rule that has been laid down that churches are not to be taxed?
Oh, Walz as well, yes.
In other words, 501c3 merely implements that.
Yes, I could justify 501c3, Mr. Chief Justice, both under a type of Mueller rationale and under the Walz rationale, which I think are quite similar. To get back to my counselor who's worried about the types of results that would come out under these so-called objective criteria, that counselor might well say, well, I'm over my head, I don't know anything about this, and I'm in an area that's religiously sensitive, I'm going to get out of it, I'm going to rely on the experts. I'll let them tell me whether or not this person has the aptitudes for the ministry, whether this school is the best school for this type of ministry, so on and so forth. But I would suggest, who are those experts? Those experts have to be church and seminary or Bible school officials themselves. So once our counselor decides to do that, then it seems to me you walk right into a Grendel's Den type of problem. You have a type of delegation. So it seems to me that however much you try, given the federal regulations and the state regulations that govern this program, there's no way to get out of this swamp. There is no way to get out of this entanglement. With respect to the free exercise clause issue, again, I would just emphasize that a state should have the option under this court's jurisprudence to say, we do not want to fund ministerial students. That is what we have said in the religion clauses of our state constitution, and I suggest that there is nothing in the free exercise clause decisions of this court which invalidate those decisions by the state of Washington as embodied in their constitution. Thank you.
Well, do you have anything further, Mr. Ferris?
Yes, sir.
You have 4 minutes remaining.
Which is his answer on the 401c3?
In response to the arguments raised by the respondent in this case, would point out, first of all, that the GI Bill, unlike the contentions of the respondent, is concerned with the career choice selected by the recipients of that bill. As we pointed out in footnote 20 of our opening brief, 38 U.S.C. Section 1673 lists a number of courses of study or career objectives which are excluded from the bill's coverage, including any course in bartending, personality development, sales courses, etc., are types of courses that the GI Bill excludes. So there is concern there by the Congress, just as there is concern by the state legislature, that people will pursue career choices that will lead to legitimate kinds of employment. Also, to answer the Chief Justice's inquiry, the solicitor brief points out in footnote 3, that Inland Empire School of the Bible is an eligible institution for people to enroll in the GI Bill. Turning to the meat of the respondents' argument, they have argued, based on speculation, as we suggested in our opening argument, about various kinds of things that might happen, could have happened, might happen under this career counseling that takes place, but they did not put any kind of this evidence in the record below. If they thought that the federal Constitution or the federal statutes or the federal regulations gave them a source of defense of this claim, they could have and should have, we would submit, put the evidence in the record below. And their failure to put that evidence in should not be charged to our account at this point. We think that this case should be decided on the record, and it should not be sent back for development of more facts, and moreover, it should not be decided at all on speculation as engaged in by the respondent.
We just reversed. Our usual mandate just says the reversed, and the case is remanded for further proceedings not inconsistent with this judgment. And then it would just be up to the Washington Supreme Court. If it thought the case was over, the case was over. But if it wanted to decide the entanglement question, I don't suppose we could say that it was forbidden to do so.
I suppose not, Your Honor, but I think if this Court held that we were correct on the Free Exercise Clause issue, that would foreclose the other inquiry in all likelihood.
So you think we really must decide the Free Exercise Clause?
It is our desire that this Court would, and we think that...
No desire. I know that what your desire is, but
you don't really think we have to, that it's really an issue that is required to be decided to reverse the Washington Supreme Court.
It is not required, absolutely, but there is no prudential consideration of the Rescue Army type of criteria for failing to do so, and we would urge this Court to decide the Free Exercise Clause issue.
If it went back to the State Supreme Court and the State Supreme Court went against you, conceivably you might be up on a free exercise claim, or you might try to get up on a free exercise claim here.
That would be correct, Your Honor. The state, we would say importantly, fails to give us any distinctions between the kind of approval process that they speculate about here and the approval process that's inherent in a building permit project by a church, and we think that that is a fatal error on their part. Finally, we would turn to the issue of the state policy, the term that has been used this morning. We would contend that there is no clear-cut state policy that prohibits the kind of aid that is in question. The state decisions before of Weiss versus Bruno, which they rely on and which the state Supreme Court relied on, said that you couldn't go to a religious college for any purpose using state monies. But today, the Attorney General has conceded that a blind student can go to Inland Empire School of the Bible or other religious colleges as long as he wants to have a secular career choice. Where is the clear-cut source of the state policy in such a circumstance?
Your time has expired.
Thank you,
Your
Honor.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll...